All right, folks, thanks for checking out the podcast. It's me, yours truly. If it's your first time to the podcast, welcome. Before we get to my guest this week, a couple of things. Flying to Omaha, where I am right now as I'm recording this, I had my flight canceled. So we had to get a new flight because there was 2 inches of snow in New York, and God forbid, 2 inches of snow. Yeah, and it's like they don't know that it's coming. It's like God like had a chain and just pulled a chain and then snow showed up. But that's not the problem. The bigger problem is the next morning I had to get my flight and we had to be de-iced. So I don't think we need to be walked through everything that's going on. Just let us sleep and shut up with the announcements. So the guy starts to explain to us they're de-icing the plane. And then he talks to us like we're six. Like, oh, you know, they're de-icing. So just imagine you're in a car, a big car with a lot of people, and it's going through a car wash. That's what we're doing. Oh, okay, thank you, because I have an IQ of six. And then he tells me the obvious, which is if you look out your window, you see there's a lot of planes. We're behind those planes. Okay, well, that's the information they give you. You know what they don't give you? You know the information they don't announce? When you're going into your connecting flight, what gate you need to go to. That might help. That might help. I know that de-icing is like a giant car wash. Great. I don't know if I'm going to get to my flight on time. That's a minor thing, I guess. All right. Listen, New Year's Eve, I'm going to be at Comics Comedy Club in Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. So come on out. I'm doing two shows New Year's Eve. Really great casino, great club. I've worked there a lot. And it'll be fun. Come, you know, gamble. Laugh, gamble some more, lose, cry, laugh some more, eat, gamble, lose. Start the new year off wrong and or right. So come. It'll be a great time. If you're anywhere near the Mohegan Sun in Connecticut, Comics Comedy Club, get tickets online. My guest, part two of my entertaining conversation with Cedric the Entertainer. Cedric and I sat down. It ended up being a long conversation. Talked about a lot of stuff, and part one was he was really great, and part two even better. So enjoy it, and hope to see you guys New Year's Eve.
Well, you know, you talked about you didn't want to get yourself trapped, and I found the same thing. I was very scared to make the jump from my traditional job to be a full-time comedian. I had a two-bedroom co-op that I owned. I was about to get married. I had the car. I had the Saab. I had the cufflinks, the whole nine yards. You know, and again, not coming from money. Hardest thing is when not coming from money and then having some money and then the prospect of not having it again scares the shit out of you, right? Yeah. And then I started to feel like a pussy because I wasn't committed to my art. You know, like I should just go and make the jump and whatever. And then I did. And I sold my apartment on the Upper West Side. I sold everything I owned except my car because I needed it to get to gigs. Right. And I moved to a rooming house in Queens. Wow. It was actually a halfway house for two ex-cons, two recovering addicts, and a 300-pound phone sex operator who sold Herbalife diet products door to door. She lived above me.
Oh,
and we shared a bathroom and a kitchen. You had like a 10-by-12 room with a bed and a little dresser and a hot pot. And you shared a bathroom and a kitchen. And I was back to go. So I go from literally like living in a penthouse apartment to this. In 6 months, and I'm like really empowered the first 6 months. I'm like, I'm doing it, man. I'm doing it. And then 6 months, and I'm like, what the fuck have I done? This is the biggest mistake of my life. And I had a lot of doubts. So did you have doubts once you were really like contemplating making that jump before you took that $60,000 a year job and got trapped? Like, how scary was it for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was one of those things. Fortunately for me, I always operated in strategies. Like, I was like, I'm the kind of person that, like, I really don't make moves unless I know where I'm doing. It's a very chess kind of mentality for me. And so, and I'll tell people, like, because people would assume that as a comedian, you're just a guy that's kind of bumping around and you kind of hopefully land in here. And all of my stuff, all of my kind of moves are strategized. Like that, when I knew that Dave Carlo was running that club, I became focused on getting Dave Carlo to see me because I knew that if I can get You see, what was that? They had 22 clubs. You can go twice a year. You were opening act at $300. I had this base. I knew it was going to be $25,000. So I'm going to drop from 40 to 25. I'm not going to drop from 40 to nothing.
Yeah.
So that was my strategy.
So now I need jobs that are going to drive to get my number to 25.
Right. So that's the only reason. Well, that's the only reason I'm going to quit. I'm not going to quit until I know I'm going to get $25,000, right?
Yeah.
So I decide, all right, cool, I get that. Then once they book me on those shows, I could quit my job. I'd saved up like $12,000, so I had a little cushion.
Yeah.
And then those were always kind of my moves. But
so you can get a lot of mac and cheese with $12,000. You can feed yourself as a
comic. Exactly. You can still do, you can still take a girl to Applebee's.
Right, exactly.
You know,
just get the appetizer.
Yeah, but hey, whoa.
Whoa, are you ordering a hamburger?
Iced tea, where you can get free refills, not soda, baby.
This date is over.
Yeah, you cannot get free Cokes over. Yeah. But iced tea, they'll just keep
Give me that drink menu. You don't need that.
Yeah, like, you don't need that. Like, I want appetizers. That's all you want? I was thinking about the salmon. Really?
Really?
You know what? I don't really. I'm kind of in a burger mood. Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here and just go get some White Castle and.
That's exactly.
Make it fun. Do something fun. Go to the beach.
Let's go for a long walk.
Yeah, a long walk in the park.
It's the winter set.
Oh, yeah. But you know, it's cool. It's still a great night.
It's midnight.
It's a great night.
Can we go to the movie? I'll tell you what. Buddy of mine is watching a movie on his TV. We stand outside his living room.
Buddy of mine is watching the movie.
Let's go to his house.
Yeah, so it was that. It's that kind of thing, like, where I just tried to, I took steps and strategized those steps to get the move. When I moved to California, it was the same thing. Like, I wasn't going to move. I had a house in St. Louis. You know, I had the car. I was committed because I had a corporate job. I had all those same thing you're talking about. I had trappings.
Yeah.
And those trappings could have, been the kind of thing. But, my house was kind of cool because it was the house I grew up in. And my mother got remarried. And so she let me buy into the house with her. So when I was working at State Farm, I kind of I took out like $12,000 and then we owned the house together.
Oh,
and
cool.
So she lived with her new husband and I stayed at the house and got a roommate.
Nice.
And, so I had like an asset, and all these kind of things. And they were just really cool little strategy moves. And so I think that's the, for me, that was the way that I kind of built my career with these great steps where I just like, when I moved to, I wasn't going to move to California until I booked the Comic View hosting job.
Did you talk, because Showtime with Apollo was your first TV gig. BET Comic View, you were, talk about that.
Coming to New York, like it was one of those things like, you could be the king of your town, but it's like when you come to New York, it is, you're in the major leagues. Like, it's just the idea of, like, at any club, any level, you can see, like, top guys. You can see big names, and then you can see guys you don't know. And they're just hilarious because they got the sharp knife because they're just, like, every night.
See, it's funny because I started here, essentially. I mean, I dabbled in New England a little bit. Like, I went up to Boston to kind of cut my teeth a little bit. So I don't see New York the same way. People coming from the outside. I can see your point, though.
Yeah, but you're right, because you're an East Coaster, and so all of that is the same for us. Like, you know, Boston, intimidating.
Yeah.
Philly, intimidating. DC, intimidating.
Had you been to New York, even to do clubs before you came to do Showtime at the Apollo?
No.
Wow.
No.
Talk about just jumping
just
into
threw
it.
Threw into it, like,
wow.
And of course, it had a reputation because it was the TV show.
Yeah.
And so it had this reputation of in and of itself. You knew what it was.
And did you have any management then or anything like that, or representation?
Just local. My local guys, like a couple of guys that, around St. Louis that kind of handle little things for me.
So you do that. That goes really well.
Goes well.
And then what happens from there?
Then they had another little show called Uptown Comedy Club. They booked me on that.
I remember that. Yeah.
There was a few guys on there that was kind of cool. And then Def Comedy Jam. So those things actually opened me up. You don't want to be honest? Yeah, it was Apollo. somehow I feel like I shot Def Comedy Jam first, but Apollo aired first.
Oh, might have been.
And maybe that was it because of Def Comedy Jam was just so. No, it was the opposite. I did the Apollo first, but then I came and shot the Def Comedy Jam, and that was still like very intimidating.
Do you find, you know, sort of in doing Comic View and hosting it for a year, was that sort of at that stage like the defining thing that kind of put you on a map on a different level and got people to start to see you as a talent to plug into TV shows and maybe film?
Without a doubt. That being on, like, what is a very specific network. It was culturally strong, where it still is. It was BET, and it was the place where black people went. But I came on every night, and because Comic View was syndicated every night, it's like watching Arsenio or Jon Stewart, yeah. I was that person, and I was presenting other comedians, but I was in control. So I was the host of the show, and it made me a star. And from there, I remember talking about that jump, like how you would go and do clubs, right? And you would say, "I ain't cool. I have to be here all weekend, even as a headliner. You know, I'm gonna make $1,100, $1,500, whatever the number is, and I'm doing eight, nine, 10, 11 shows,
right? And then morning."
I went from that world to literally making $2,300 a night.
Wow.
Because I was on every day.
Yeah.
Like, I was this person that I could come to town just as me. Like, the host of Comic View, they would be able to say that in Augusta, Georgia, and that worked. And so I can do, like, venues, and I was killing. And then, Def Comedy Jam was popular to where it was so popular that anybody could do a comedy jam. And so if you were a name, like a name, and was being able to sell, I jumped quickly from 23 to 5, from 5 to 10, 10 to 18 in probably 22 months.
Oh, my God.
That's how fast it was. It was the craziest.
I fucking hate you.
The craziest.
Give me money right now, you asshole. Go into your bedroom and get me some fucking money. Or the millionaire host is going to accidentally have a slip and fall out of this fucking window. God, I feel like a loser. I should have stayed on Wall Street. You know why? Because you're black. That's why. You're not even that funny. It's because you're black,
that's
asshole.
What they always do, right? Yeah.
And by the way,
you wish that could work. Like, you put that in percentages, right? And black people, like, that's how we see white guys. What the fuck, man? What the fuck all that money again? What the fuck is Owen Wilson? The fuck he got $2 million a picture for what?
Again with the Owen Wilson. He's made this movie 5 times. He put a different hat on.
Yeah, same fucking movie. Like $10 million a movie. Where the fuck is that money?
Oh my God. Well, as a host of that thing, that's a whole different role again.
Exactly.
You're driving the bus. Now you're not the guy at the center of it, but you gotta have those moments and drive it and sort of step out of the way and let the other person do it. Was again sort of going back to your experience hosting as a young comic, I would imagine all that helped with the BET thing, right?
Exactly. And you end up writing a lot more. Because
writing what?
Material. Just because, you got to fill up these spaces. So you end up trusting things that you wouldn't necessarily put on a real act because you just got to do it. So now you end up having a lot more discovery. But when you get, kind of trapped into an act and you get trapped into, fearful about making sure you don't make, the wrong step, which is kind of like, it's really weird is where I feel now. It's like, I feel like it's harder when you are known to be able to just kind of walk on stage and just do shit.
Yeah.
Like, people have all these expectations, and inside those expectations, it prevents you from being like this person that just like
wants to explore and try and fail. Chris Rock talks about that. Robin Williams talks about that. They'll come down to the Comedy Cell and they'll go on, and it's like, and Chris will go up with his yellow pad and he'll have his own. And Chris is, notorious for always writing new stuff.
Right.
Like, and you can see, like, you'll jump into a couple of tried and true in the middle of there. Because there's that, I don't care how big you are, man, you don't want to go too long without that laugh.
Without that laugh, right, yeah. And if
so how do you balance that? That goes back to what we were talking about earlier, sort of like you want to give them what they want and expect, but you're going to blow your brains out if you're doing the same thing for 20 years.
Exactly.
So how do you...
Well, I mean, that's why I think why I never really ever let stand-up go. Like, I never let it go. No matter how, you know, great everything else is, movies, television shows,
why?
All that, because it's and even talking about one that let stand-up go, it's the place where you have to deliver.
Yeah.
Like, it's literally
You think it keeps you sharp for everything else? Because it's a very different discipline, and listeners should understand that. You are a very good actor. You're a really good dramatic actor. You have moments in the first Barbershop movie in particular. I remember like where the streets are on fire and you talk about what you did that years earlier and protecting helping his father. And obviously David Mamet, you know, doesn't just put anybody in his plays. But you need a different discipline as an actor. Our job as comedians is to kind of split our minds on stage, right? So we're doing our act, but we're also listening to the audience and the reaction. Like, oh, man, they're not going for my joke about Poland Spring Water here. This run isn't going to work. I'm going to shift gears, right? Because we are performers and entertainers and want to, you know, deliver the goods. Acting, you're going to screw yourself if you do that. You've got to be in relationship minute one, right? And only in that, and not obsessing your performance from the outside, right? Where did your acting chops come from? Did you take acting classes? Did you study? Because you're really great at it.
No, the same thing for me, probably, I did some acting. I minored in acting in college. And I did a lot of plays, but I never taken it real serious. It was just the fact that I always wanted to, like, you know, I think that for me, when I did my comedy and I committed to these characters as a joke, I had to commit, like I had to be the guy. And that's when I used to trust, I knew I can get freedom. So Barbershop was a great story about that character that I played in Barbershop, because I used to have a security guy, and he was like a friend of mine, but he was like a guy, you know, he was from Detroit, he was fucking a thug, you know, he was just fucking troubled as human being, and only somebody like me can really deal with him, because he just was fucking like,
again,
you know,
calling the wolf.
He just,
he claims he just
I just want to fucking fight in the world. Like, he'd be like, my man, everybody's not mad at you, calm down.
Yeah.
And so I was helping him grow, but he was, you know, he was a good friend of mine, and he loved comedy, which was the opposite of his outside personality. Like, he loved jokes and and I had two different ways I was going to play the character. And I did the voice that, you know, the character ended up being. He was like, that's it. And so I would sit around with him and just practice with no dialogue, just be the guy, be this old man, like just sitting with him so I could make him laugh.
Wow.
And then once I got it, that's when I was on stage, I can do anything with him now because I know exactly who he is.
This is the character of Eddie
on Barbershop.
Where did that voice come from?
It was a combination. It was a guy that was like he went to our church and he was a friend of the family. He was just old man and he was a friend of the family. And he was this, you know, and he was just this guy. And then where my
grandma. He talked like that? He really was?
He had a high voice, but it wasn't quite as like that as Eddie. And then when I found Eddie, I just kind of stayed there. I just stayed where it was. And then once I kind of found the cadence, it don't matter. Shit, you can add me in a goddamn thing. He had opinion about shit, and that was the thing. This dude, and there was another guy who had all these opinions. This other old man, he was dead set on everything, and he was so convincing that I was like, this guy could sell you shit because he was so believable. You just believed it. And I knew that Eddie had to say some really hard things, so you had to go like, all right, who has the guts to say these things? Somebody who's old enough to know that and believe that it's true.
Yeah.
Like, they have enough you know, integrity in who they are, that they, what if they say something, they believe is true.
Did that scare you away, that first script at all, and sort of some of the things that Eddie had to say? Because obviously there were kind, there was controversy after it, but like in going into it, you're a smart guy. You had to know, oh, okay, well, I'm going to say Rosa Parks didn't do anything. It's like...
Well, again, you know, it was tough. You know, you had to find it. I remember, like, I had a conversation with my mom about it, and she, you know, of course, she's from that era where, you know, everybody is kind of, you know, idolized and all these characters. And I was like, so I end up, because my mother's a school teacher, we got into a debate about it. And I end up reading something where Rosa Parks wasn't the first person to do it, right?
Right.
So if she wasn't the first person to do it, that's really his statement.
Yeah.
It sounds mean and it sounds hard.
But it is based in some factual fact.
And then, so imagine if you, and then that's what I would do. Imagine if you were friends with, you know, James Wilson, and he sat down on the bus first. He got his ass beat. He went to jail. Nobody gave a fuck.
He'd be like,
and he's your friend.
Excuse me. He's gonna be like,
I'm gonna be like, fuck that. This guy is the guy. Yeah. Like, this guy is the guy. Like, you will take up for your guy. Like, it's just the truth.
Right.
And that's kind of where I based all of that from. And it was controversial, but, you know, when I got into debates with people, I was able to explain it in truth because I read it. I was like, look, man, that's the truth.
A couple of things about that. I read that you, in the middle of this controversy, and people who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, basically, your character, Eddie, and I'll let you tell it, says a couple of things about Rosa Parks, and then what happened?
Right. I'd say in the character, I say, you know, Rosa Parks, she didn't do nothing but sit up, black ass down, you know, boom, boom. I say Martin Luther King was a hoe. It's all these things that, again, that were controversial in the images of great civil rights icons and leaders. And as a character in the barbershop, one, it was like, one, we're in the barbershop. Like, this is the truth about the barbershop. Yes. We're telling this very specific story. I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. I didn't write the words. I'm acting them out. And I did change them to make sure that I was comfortable enough saying them. But, you know, like, because the guy had written some shit that I felt was disrespectful, I ain't say it that way. I knew, I took his sentiment and was like, this is what I'm going to say, right? So everybody was fine with it. And it still was controversial. I remember one of the producers quit the movie.
Really?
He quit the movie when it was said. He was
in the middle of the shoot.
It was a young producer on it, but he just
obviously black,
young black African American guy. He just was so offended by it.
Wow!
And then, you know, I seen him years later, and he still tried to hold the grudge. We had a little talk about it, and then, you know, he realized that his passion. I was like, most of the things that we do as African Americans, we base so much shit off emotion and very little off fact.
Yeah.
And so
I'm Italian, we do the same thing.
Same thing. It's just like we're so emotional about how we feel that we don't really care about the facts. And
is that because, and take this the right way, because blacks have been oppressed and feel like they almost have earned the right to sort of gloss over the facts a little bit?
Of course. I think so. I mean, when you're...
I knew that's why I didn't like you people.
Yeah.
I knew
same
it.
Same thing. It's the same thing. It's the same thing like Italians. Like, you son of a bitches think you know food.
Right.
Fucking everybody can't cook Italian food.
Exactly. Well, you know what? It's because your character, Eddie, and says something... in the rant, he goes, OJ's innocent. OJ did it.
Right.
Your character says, OJ did it, right? And the rest of the barbershop goes, no, he did not.
Right.
And, you know, look, blacks for that moment in time, I know they felt deserved to have a black guy get off, but, you know, you guys are living in denial there, right? I have an Italian family.
Right.
One of my cousins is a small-time hood in the mob. He runs numbers, fronts a woman's shoe store, and he sells literally stuff that like out of the trunk of his car. But nobody in our family will truly acknowledge that he's doing anything wrong. He's just, you know, making a little money.
Right.
And I feel like ethnicities and races sort of band together at certain points in time when it's convenient for them. And that reaction that was written, albeit we're talking about a movie, but I thought the movie, because my uncle had a barbershop.
Right.
But it was all Italians went to the barbershop. But it was the same kind of thing. The stuff that they would say in that barbershop
right.
should not leave those four walls.
Right.
And frankly, even about black people, like racist stuff about black
exactly.
people. Yeah, they're all on welfare, they're this and that.
Exactly.
And I had to get that stuff out of my head because I was like sitting there, I'm 10, waiting to get a haircut, and I'm hearing this stuff about the Puerto Ricans and the this and the that or whatever. But my point is that that moment in that movie was a powerful moment because I do think, you know, maybe probably this day, there's a fair number of black people that think, you know, O.J., you know, don't say that O.J. was wrong, you know, not guilty. He would defend O.J. to this day. Is that ever going to change in this culture? Do you think we're always going to have, you know, races sort of banding together and ethnicities banding together?
Yeah, no, that is a part of the America's identity. For people to assume that, you know, getting along means, you know, not being who you are. You know, it's just what it is. Like, people are comfortable with who they're with. You know, they're comfortable inside their culture. They're comfortable inside their families. You are raised. You are a product of your parents and your community. So you're raised to with a lot of these kind of things.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, ultimately you realize you live in a bigger community. And if you ever have the chance to be outside of your neighborhood,
yeah.
you recognize that people pretty much are all the same,
yeah.
no matter what, you know. Now that takes some growth. However, you're still gonna have biases and things that you know, kind of go like, I just kind of feel this way about it. Like, you know, I've grown to be one that, like, you know, I know my people. I know other people. I know racist.
Mm.
I get racist. When, you know, you got a racist point of view, like, all right, motherfucker, you're a racist.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
And there ain't much and you're going to do to change.
What the fuck I'm going to do with that? Like, but recognize that's who you are. Like, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm not even mad about who you are. How about that?
Like, well,
I'm
you're actually going to feel bad for that person on some
because
level.
Because you're spending so much time worried about shit you'll never be able to fix.
Right, exactly.
Like, dog, the fuck you going to be?
Exactly.
Like, you cannot fucking kill everybody not like you. Like, this not gonna happen.
Well, you know, you talk about, like, you've talked about sort of that your comedy needs to come from a truthful place.
Right.
And there's something that you say in your special, it's really funny, but like, you talk about, like, when big white shows go off the air, like Friends, it's like this
right.
big, like, you know, NBC is
right.
and then when black shows go off the air, like, Steve Harvey.
Yeah, Steve Harvey was like, he got fired on Friday. I didn't even know it was the last day until I saw the cake. I was like, what the hell?
But like, there's something really, you know, honest and truthful about that. And again, this kind of goes to that question of, like, is it going to change? I mean, do you see it where, like, you know, I mean, the whites kind of get sort of one kind of treatment and the blacks and the minorities get another kind of treatment, or with a black president now in a much more melting pot of a country? I mean, soon I think Indian people are going to be probably the biggest race in this
yeah.
country. Like, do you see that changing ever? And do you see you talking about that kind of stuff more in your act as you do your next special or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, these are the kind of things that you are aware of, because I think that, you know, it's getting more and more to the have and the have-nots before you get culturally, you know, changed. And even then, it's always been that, because even then, it's all about who has and who has not
right.
inside that. But, you know, we're starting to be in a global world. You recognize, and I say, whenever you go outside the U.S., you recognize it even more. Like, you become U.S. pride. You forget all racism
right, exactly.
when your ass is
right.
over somewhere and they don't give a shit about you
yeah.
being American.
Suddenly,
right?
that white guy or that Puerto Rican guy,
yeah,
like in America's your
just,
best
yeah,
friend
that
now in Italy.
Fucking Oregon, and he's like, yo, I'm from America too. You're like, oh shit, what's up the fuck, dog? Like, like, you're right, this whole, like, Puerto Rican Mexican, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
As long as we together right now, like,
because this guy from Norway is scaring the shit
yeah,
out of me.
Dude, it's fucking weird with those little leather jackets. And those fucking techno, everybody's got a techno. That's fucking Norway for you. Like, everybody's a fucking techno DJ.
Norway freaks. If I see one on the street today, I'm gonna fuck them.
Everybody
up.
Skrillex. Like, so.
But, you know, I agree with you. Like, I don't know. I do think that sort of there is a kind of a herd mentality. in our culture. And I don't know if that changes. You know what I mean? Do you feel like with Obama being in office, he made it a point not to sort of make his race an issue?
Right.
And I mean, you know, for yourself and, you know, someone who's a voice in the black community, right? Do you feel like that he should have done that more? Or do you think he's handled that well?
Yeah, I think for his job, I think that he's handled it well. I think, you know, the thing about being a president for everybody is that we already know that you're going to represent your fucking crew. Like, if Mitt Romney would have got played, you already know he's down for the Mormons. There's no reason to be. But if he would have only
suddenly it's like free parking for the Mormons.
Yeah, right, like Mormons is just balling out and you like know it. You're like, look at them. You know, you knew when Bush was in president, but everybody in Texas, all the big oil people, they fucking ate like fucking dog. They was eating like it was just, and Texas was the big deal and everything was happening in Texas, and it's like, everybody know you're going to get your part. The thing about, you know, of course, being the first black anything is that you do have to kind of keep people from panicking that you're gonna do it. You know,
you mean that you're gonna fuck up?
That you're just gonna fucking give the black people the fucking all this shit. Like, you cannot do that. That would fucking mean.
What do you mean Friday's mandatory fried chicken day? Yeah, come on, President Obama.
I don't like fucking loud colors. Like, you know, the fact that, you know, like I used to say, when he had the stimulus program, black people thought he was just going to come through and just make it rain. Like, we don't want to go and fill out a program. When you say you about to give out $400-500 billion, just come through and get that shit out, man. Like, fuck, boy, I got to go fill out paper. Like, just be like you at the King of Diamonds strip club and just throw that shit down. Like, fuck, dog, like... Dog, me write my name down on a piece of paper. That's
we're good. We're tight, man. We're brothers.
That's not black at all, bro. You doing it the white way. That's not black, man. So, you know, we got a totally different idea of what he's supposed to be doing anyway. So, you know.
But you did it. You performed as a White House correspondent.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, like, I've done corporate gigs. You've done corporate gigs. And, you know, they usually go pretty well. But then there's always that awkward, like, conversation after with like, the really, like, uptake guys that run. So what's it like after you did a great job? But, like, afterwards, like, is it, like, what's it like after doing something like that? Just hanging with the big wigs, the politicians, the president?
Yeah. I mean, it's really cool because, you know, you get pulled inside this other part of the world, like, you had no idea, like, oh, this is where all the caviar is. Like,
I see.
Oh, so there is gold in every fucking bowl of fucking Lucky Charms. Like, these motherfuckers live a totally different as existed. Like, so, but, you know, again, it's one of those things.
Did you steal an ashtray? Just tell me.
I should have looked for something to get fucking pinned. I just wanted some shit.
They walk in the room. It goes like a perfect night you kill, and then they see you putting like a silver
on
ashtray
on the camera. But do it anyway. See, catch myself. I can't help it. I got a fucking spill.
Boom.
I'm black. I'm gonna spill.
It's what we do.
Fuck it. You got it. You knew it was gonna happen. Fucking Big Brother's watching. That's what I say. I wanna go. When I went to see President Obama, I was like, I just want to see the sock drawer. Like, I want to see some real shit. Like, I don't want to fuck. I've been here.
You want to know that? You want to know that he's like down to earth?
Like, yeah, like, do you like put fucking a wave cap on at night? Like, some black shit.
Do you have a chair in your bedroom where you throw all your
all your shit on? Your wife always asks you, like, would you please? Like,
do you have a post-it that says "Call Putin"? Like,
you haven't called. January.
It's got a coffee stain on the post-it. It's been sitting there for 6 months. Please tell me you're like me.
You are. I know. The same shit. Like, yo, got the same pair of sweats you'd rather put on. Like, your wife got to make you put on some shit.
Like, were they cool afterwards, though? Is it just hanging?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Both of them, you know, actually... both, you know, I didn't perform for President Clinton, but I did like a fundraising event with him. And then both Obama and George W. Bush was so cool. I talk about how, you know, like he was this personality you see on TV and you think like, dude, I'm going to give you, you know, when I see you, I got all these jokes. But he was so personable, man. He was like
Bush and Obama.
Both of them. They, you know, and Clinton is the kind of guy that can remember you from when you were in the eighth grade.
Like, he's got that thing. He did the Daily Show one time and I brought my son just to kind of, and I put my son like in a spot where I knew he was going to have to walk through.
Right.
And my son was young. And there was that moment, because they say he has this ability to, like, look at you and make you feel like you're the only person in the world. And he looked at my son for, like, 30 seconds. Hey, what's your name? Alex, nice to meet you, buddy. We're in school. And he's talking to him, and, like, like, I was ready to have sex with the guy. They have that ability,
right? That's his move. That's his move. He's had a lot of sex with guys before that.
He hands you a blue dress, says, put it on.
Get a cigar and get up.
You know, it's going to be bad.
It happens. But, yeah, no, he's like that. Like, and really memorable. Like, I was in Vegas one time, and he was in, the Joe's Crab check in the Joe's Crab House, the Stone Crab, the classy one, in the Caesars, and I was walking down the hall, and I saw like all the security, but I had no idea who it was because it's Vegas. You don't know who the fuck it's gonna be. So I kept going, and all of a sudden, Secret Service comes up to me and says, "Cedric, President Clinton wants to see you." And he saw me walk past and actually sent somebody for me.
Wow.
How cool was that?
Oh my God.
Because he remembered me, like, from, and he was like, he saw me walk past and he looked and he sent the guys to come get me and sit back and talk, like, laugh for a few minutes. And I was just like, this dude is like, that's a great shit right there.
Wow. And you guys hung and talked for a little bit?
Just for a few minutes because, you know, everybody was around him. But he wanted to make sure that I saw him. So he came back and I came and said hello and we chatted for a quick minute and he was like, good seeing you, man. You know, how's your wife? He remembered my wife and he was like, boom.
Wow.
He was like, all right. And I was like, you know, honor and a pleasure. Introduced him to my couple of friends I was with, so that they was sitting there like, what the fuck? I was like, dude.
Dumbass claims adjuster.
Yeah, from that guy, right? You know?
You ever have those moments where you're like, I can't like believe that I'm like, you gotta like, that's had to be one of those moments, right?
Where, oh yeah, that was one. Cause you
know, from St. Louis.
Right. You don't understand it, you know. And I've been having, you know, you just don't understand.
See, but this is the thing that goes back to what you were saying when you were 9. And I think a similar thing with me, like, I kept thinking that I was picking comedy and it picked me.
Yeah.
Right? Because I tried to suppress it. I was like, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to do it part-time. Then I left. I told you I moved to the rooming house. I got so freaked out. I went back to Wall Street, recreated my life, swore off comedy, got a new apartment in the city, moved my girlfriend back in. Swore it off. Not done. Done. 2 months later, I was back in the clubs like an alcoholic needing a drink.
Right.
And I think the same thing with you. Like, you figured out a way. Even his mom obviously loves you and thought the best thing was to not encourage that.
Right.
You fought your way like through wanting to do that. And don't you think, for people out there that are trying, because I get people come up to me all the time, we're like, hey, I'm thinking, I'm an engineer, but I hate it and I want to be a writer. Like, what do you say to people who kind of think they want to do this at any age and whatever the whatever the art is?
Go on the stage.
Yeah.
That's the, I mean,
paint, write, whatever.
Write, do it, act, do it without worrying about the money. If you love it and it's something you want to do, then do it. Like, that's really, because you can't live life, you know, like not trying things. You can't live life believing that somehow, you know, it's just going to happen for you out of the blue. Like I said, that desire to go on stage and to lead that and doing that one step at a time, it leads you. You know, we talk about my the other guy that helped write on the show, Malik, young guy. He has this thing of looking at the things. So he looks at, like, my cars, and he goes, how do you do it? I said, dude, that car, man, has been sitting in the driveway in for fucking 3 months. I don't worry about that car. Like, I do it for the fact that I like to do what I do. It led me to the success, and, you know, and those things allow me. I never came in this thing like, oh, I want to have the big, because when you realize it, it's so many people with more. Like, I did it. Like, as big as I'm doing it right now, I'll go and hang with Diddy, and I'm a fucking squashed.
So then when you go home after a night with Diddy and you feel, quote unquote, squashed, right?
Right.
Do you lie in bed and go, I want more, or I'm happy where I am, and I live with it, and I'm good with it? Honestly.
No, it's probably all of those things for me. Like, it's the aspect of seeing it and realizing it's attainable. If it's a certain lifestyle, you go, like, it's just the brand of life. Classic. We performed for the troops. So it's me, Diddy. We were down in Texas. It was this whole thing. We performed for the troops. We were in Austin, outside of Austin. And it was a Miss America girl there. She had just became Miss America. And we were all having this great time. We were all together having fun. And so Miss America was like, oh, you know, we were out on the base. So she says, you know, what are you doing afterwards? I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to go back to the hotel in Austin. It's a great, you know, town. We can go, you know, some restaurants. We can hang out, you and your crew. Just have some fun, right? But Diddy comes, goes, I'm going to hop on the jet. I'm flying to Dallas. I'm doing an after party, and then I can send you guys back later on tonight. She looked at me. Go, Cedric, are you going to come? I'm like, nah. I don't think I want to be in the middle of that. Well, you know, like, I was invited, but I got four other guys with me, you know?
Yeah.
Like, of course, Puff was like down. He, like, he let me go. Yeah, but he don't want four dudes.
Exactly.
He wants your crew. Like, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't have a way to get back tonight. Like,
I don't have
a jet where.
I got a scooter.
Yeah. And it's like, you're talking about, you know, from Austin to Dallas, but that's the difference.
Yeah.
But you go, do I want to have that?
See, but when is it? But that's the thing in our culture, not just us as comedians or whatever act. When is it enough, right? Like that's part of that's the great thing about America and the bad thing about America, right?
Yeah.
Like my brother-in-law is American, lives in Denmark, lived there for 20 years, met his girlfriend there when he was in college, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Socialized democracy. Basically have like an 80% middle class. Very few poor, very few rich. It's great, but for anybody with a little bit of, you know,
moxie
and, you know, hustle, you can't break out of that 80%. It's very, very hard because the taxes at the upper level are so high to fund the socialized democracy. Like, he tried to run his own business and it went under because, and so on one hand, that's good. On the other hand, if you're not that kind of person, it's bad. That's the problem with, like, I think our culture in a way. It's like, it's never enough. It's like, I get people say, hey, when are you going to get your own TV show? Oh, yeah. Like, I go home, like my Italian relatives. You know, I keep forgetting. I got to just call NBC and say, hey, I'm ready for my show now. It's like, I'm building are building to get there. I'd love to have my own TV show. That's my dream, right? To have a film career, right? And it's like, how do you temper that for you, given how much you've achieved, to go, you know what? Hey, I'm good. I'm not going to settle, but I'm not going to drive myself crazy that I don't have the private jet. Like,
that's
where
the
do
key.
You?
I mean, that is the key, is to enjoy the ride. Because, like you say, in every day and in every circumstance is somebody that it gives you inspiration. And even the reason I'm doing, would be able to say, I take the time out of my day to do this interview with you is because once I start hearing you work, I was inspired by stand-up. Like, I got all these people around me. I know I got this job, but when I hear you do warm-up.
Me?
Yeah, and I tell you that. I was like, yo, you're killing them today,
yeah.
Boom, boom. It's a thing that allows me to be me. Like, I'm like, oh, like, dude, you can be free. Like, this dude is free.
Yeah.
Like, he's not worried about, like, calling people whores or bitches. Let him don't fucking worry about it. Like, I'm so busy. Like, yo, I gotta be sad.
Yeah.
I don't wanna make ABC mad.
Yeah.
All right, well, look, if you can go there, I can go here. I might not slice like I would if I was to stay. But I understand now that inside the freedom of being who you are is where you find... you can have greatness, and you can get that from so many places. So therefore, it don't really matter who got what. Like, you already recognize, like, you know, like I said, you know, it's I've been to Diddy apartment in New York. It ain't this. It ain't even this. And it's still, it's Diddy. At the same time, I know that he's got like 9 other houses, and I've been to his big ass house in Miami and all that. But it's like, okay, at the end of the day, people just kind of do what they do. And, you know, and some people do it way up here. And at the end of the day, they still a regular ass guy that's like, fuck, man, my knee hurts. shit, my wife hates me.
I gotta go see my mother-in-law today.
Oh, man, my illegitimate child is calling me for money. Like, it's all the fucking same. Yeah. Like, you get it, you know? So, if you enjoy the ride, you embrace the ride, which is, you know, one of the things I have more fun with. So, you know, even though, you know, you want the ability to have the flexibility to do what it is you want to do when you want to do it, that's it appears to be greed, but that's what I liked about that move more than it was greed. It was the fact that he had the option. The option was his. It was not controlled to go on that trip to say, I'm going to go to Dallas and boom, boom, boom. Yes, does it seem like it's a lot, but I'm
the last person to judge somebody else's success. If that's what he's got and he's got the ability.
And you got the option. If you have that option, it's like, yo, you have a choice today. Like, if you can do something with your kids and your family and it truly was like your call, like it wasn't like, I can't do it. It's like, oh. My son wants to go to Disney World and, you know, he wants to do it. And I can literally get up and do it.
Right.
Do it. Right. Like, and that's what you kind of work for. Those are the things you desire. And if you put that in context, you know, success helps drive that, but it doesn't necessarily make you who you are.
Well, a little bit. I mean, yeah, I agree with you, but I personally, sometimes I tie my own sense of self-worth to my achievements and what I've done. And I don't know if you do that or you're beyond that now, right. But like, you know, some days I feel really good about myself. Yeah. And then some days I'm like, I'm ready. You know, I'm ready to break out. When's it going to happen? You know, you're like kind of, you know, feel like you're banging your head against the wall. But then, you know, my wife always pulls me back and goes, hey, can you step back and look at what, you know, you got Emmy Awards from The Daily Show and this and that. You know, you've done some like significant. So I think it's that constant battle of like just sort of keeping it in perspective.
Yeah.
Like wherever you are. I just want to finish up. But you're directing.
Yeah.
Has that changed how you act and deal with directors once you got behind the camera as a director yourself? And why do you want to direct?
You know, I think it was, you know, it's just kind of a growth of, you know, kind of visualizing. Like, even when you write a joke and you kind of, you see where it can go. You know that you have certain limitations on stand up on a stage to be able to deliver that off. And then it's this thing to say, all right, cool, I want to tell this whole story. Like, I need you to understand, like, the circumstance that's going on. And now I can deliver this joke. And so that's kind of was, you know, how my directing energy grew, so that I want to be able to kind of tell a story. And this one, in that particular film, it was simple. It was a silly idea, and it was silly enough to where I wanted to do it. And yet I was really kind of stretched, and I was spread really thin. So I had a great time directing the movie, and I think I did a great job at it, and now I want to be better.
Yeah.
Now I just want to be better because it's like, all right, cool, that was the first one, but like anything, just do it.
Yeah, listen, I can't thank you enough for doing this, man. This is a lot of fun, man.
Yeah, man, it was good. Thank you, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's at least like 5 minutes of it.
You can get with a short edit. Yeah.
Thank you, man. You're the best.
All right, right on, baby.
All right, that was Cedric the Entertainer. He's entertaining. I got to tell you, that name really lives up. You know, he lives up to the name. Hope you guys come see me, Mohegan Sun Comics Comedy Club, New Year's Eve. It's going to be a great time doing 2 shows. You can get tickets online, Comics Comedy Club. And we will catch up to you next week. Have a great week, everybody.